I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a question. What is the American idea? And we'll have the answers from some big thinkers, including Ray Kurzweil. But first, did you notice the turning point in the presidential race over the weekend? That's what the annual Jefferson Jackson Dinner for Democrats in Iowa has come to be called. Did it deliver this year? By most accounts, Senator Barack Obama hit a home run, giving a forceful speech to fired-up supporters. And there was other political news over the weekend. Seven presidential candidates graced the Sunday morning talk shows on one. Struggling Republican John McCain predicted he'd win New Hampshire. And two new polls show Republican Mitt Romney solidifying his lead in that state, and Hillary Clinton slipping a bit. For a quick Monday morning review, Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, first, what did Barack Obama say on Saturday night that so wowed people? He gave his speech late in the evening, too late to make the Sunday newspapers.
That's right. Maybe too late for the Sunday papers, but early enough for the Monday papers and for the Sunday shows to go over time and time again. Basically, what he said is that the old style of politics isn't going to work anymore, and that he criticized Senator Clinton indirectly by saying it's time that we start telling the truth, that we aren't afraid to address big issues. And it was hitting at a theme that in the wake of the debate 2 weeks ago in Philadelphia, a lot of the Democrats have been talking about, that Senator Clinton is too cautious, that she acts as if she's got the nomination wrapped up, that she refuses to be pinned down on some major issues. And he's calling for a bolder type of politics. A lot of observers saying it may have been his best rhetorical performance since the Democratic convention in Boston in 2004 that really launched him to political superstardom.
But then again, Salon.com's Walter Shapiro writes that while Obama, you know, may have, as you're saying, found his voice Saturday night, he fizzled on Sunday morning on his Meet the Press TV appearance. He had the whole hour. And he, according to Shapiro, gave a long-winded, indirect answer when pressed to identify who he was accusing of, quote, talking and acting and voting like a George Bush Republican, which was the statement from Saturday night. You know, what was your sense of that?
Oh, yeah. It's a question that's come up time and time again with Barack Obama. He's gone out on several occasions and said, I'm going to be more aggressive now. I'm going to start fighting. I'm going to start showing what the differences are. And then when he's pressed on it and in different forums, he seems to back away from the fight. The question about whether it's actually in his DNA or not, a lot of his campaign advisors say that's just Barack Obama being who he is and being true to himself, that it's not in his nature to be a fighter. He's more of a consensus builder or a conciliator. And that's frustrated a lot of his supporters, who feel like the only way to beat Hillary Clinton when she's up 20 or 30 points in national polls is to really rough her up. He's shown flashes where he's willing to do that. He's gone out and said he's going to do it. He has a speech like he did on Saturday. But then 8 hours later on the Sunday morning talk show, he has an opportunity to continue that, and he backs off. And I think people are definitely, you know, and rightly confused by that and sometimes disappointed.
Let's look at the Republican side on this Monday morning. Republican Mitt Romney trailing Rudy Giuliani in the national polls, but the Romney campaign has to be happy about the polls that came out this weekend.
Yes, I think there are two New Hampshire polls that looked great for Mitt Romney, has him solidifying his lead in New Hampshire. He's in an interesting spot now. He is very much expected to win both Iowa and New Hampshire. In the past, that has been, as John Kerry can tell you, a way to glide your way to the nomination. But if everyone expects him to win those two, you know, first of all, if he loses either one of them, it's seen as devastating. And secondly, because it's so expected, he won't get as much of a bounce as he would if it had been unexpected. So it's a cruel, cruel game that these guys are all engaged in.
Well, but there was also buzz this weekend as to whether or not Mitt Romney is going to give that Kennedy-like speech explaining his Mormonism.
Yes, it's been the big question. We saw John McCain's mother on MSNBC on Friday night opining on Mormons in a very public way, in a not-so-nice way. We've also seen Mitt Romney joking about his own religion, making a joke the other day about, I've got five sons and they have five wives, but that's one wife each. But he also said over the weekend something really interesting, that some of his advisors have been telling him not to give that big speech, that the speech is essentially ready to go, it's prepared, but they are worried about essentially introducing him to a large segment of the public as the Mormon candidate. They want him to be the conservative candidate who happens to be Mormon instead. So we're now, you know, 55, 60 days out before Iowa, so that window is closing fast. So there's, I think, intensified speculation over when indeed he'll give a speech. I think most people think it will happen at some point. In and outside the Romney camp, there's an assumption that he will give this speech at some point. They'll know that he'll have one shot to get it right and to do it well, and that, you know, it'll be a huge national media sensation when it's done, but they want to make sure it's done at the right moment.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, if someone asked you to define the American idea, what would you say? Is it democracy, one man, one woman, one vote? Well, to mark its 150th anniversary, The Atlantic magazine asked an eclectic group of thinkers to offer their thoughts on the American idea and the greatest challenges to it in the future. They were asked to contribute essays of about 300 words, a challenge met precisely by Judith Martin, Miss Manners. Her reply was exactly 300 words. In it, she said the original idea was etiquette, everyone treated with respect and dignity. Tom Wolfe, on the other hand, mused on Thomas Jefferson's idea of America for more than 2,000 words, coming back to all men are created equal. Wolfe says, only in America are children routinely asked by visitors, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, the essays are featured in the November issue of The Atlantic that's entitled The Future of the American Idea. In a moment, we'll speak to the editor of this special issue to get more response. But we're joined now by one of the contributors, Ray Kurzweil, inventor of the first print-to-speech reading machines for the blind, the first music synthesizer, and a provocative advocate of the role of technology in the future. Ray Kurzweil, welcome back to Here Now.
Great to be with you again, Robin.
What is your idea of the American idea?
It's pushing beyond frontiers, where we started, if you remember, with Manifest Destiny, New Frontiers in Geography, science, splitting the atom, DNA, invention, the telephone, light bulb, the airplane, the internet, industry, we fostered mass production, and even in cultural domains, we are a cultural leader today, music, jazz, rock and roll, these are the two big musical movements of the 20th century emerging from America, popular culture. So this is my idea of the American idea.
Is innovation and pushing beyond walls and frontiers and boundaries.
And it's kind of a manifestation of what human beings are all about, because we're really the only species that does that. We didn't stay on the ground. We didn't stay on the planet. We haven't stayed within the limitations of our biology. Human life expectancy was 25 1,000 years ago. It was 37 only 200 years ago. So we are going beyond our limitations, and that's been a quintessential American idea, the idea of progress. And it's not just computers. It's also areas like biology, reprogramming our genetic makeup. We can turn genes on, add new genes. And we're doubling the power of these technologies every year. That's multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years, a billion in 30 years. It's actually 25 years to be exact. And if you look at how powerful these technologies are today, how influential the internet is with a $2 trillion economy on it, imagine multiplying the power of all of these technologies a billionfold in the next quarter century, you get some idea of what will be feasible.
Well, and the way that this is manifested, my grandmother would never, ever, we've heard these conversations before. She couldn't have imagined emailing movies and sound. Of course, we can do that. You're extrapolating from that in 20 years, we might be emailing three-dimensional products?
That's right. In the future, I'll be able to email you a file, and you'll have this tabletop factory device that can actually print out three-dimensional objects of almost any type. So I can email you a blouse and you'll print it out on your three-dimensional fabricator, or a meal. I can email you the toaster or the toast. Or you can...
I can't. What, now, but you see, words are one thing and a sound wave is one thing. How do you email a piece of toast?
Well, there's already devices that can print out three-dimensional objects, and in fact, they can include electronics. And the scale of these and the precision is getting finer and finer to the point where we will actually be able to take individual molecules, not one at a time, because that would take too long, trillions at a time, and reorganize them into other products. And you'll be able to make almost anything from an information file. One thing we'll be able to make, for example, is very inexpensive solar panels. And we'll be able to capture enough energy from the sun to meet 100% of our energy needs. And they might say, well, is there really enough sunlight? There's actually 10,000 times more sunlight than we need. We only need to capture one part in 10,000 to meet 100% of our energy needs. We'll be able to do that with these extremely inexpensive nano-engineered solar panels and store the energy in little storage devices, nano-engineered fuel cells. So that's just one of the areas that will be transformed by these technologies.
This is where the conversation went when you were asked to talk about what the American idea is, and you characterize it as something that's about pushing boundaries, pushing beyond limitations. But is this exclusively an American idea? I mean, I'm thinking of all the innovations that have come from around the world. I mean, why is...
It's not exclusively an American idea. If you go back a few hundred years ago, the idea of progress didn't exist. People's grandparents lived the same lives they did. They expected their grandchildren to do the same, and that was largely borne out. This began to change around the Industrial Revolution. which was actually not born in the United States, although it got impetus from American innovations like mass production and all the inventions we've had here. But it's a quintessential American idea, the idea of progress, of confronting problems and overcoming them by the application of human thought, and not just in technology, but also in politics and social culture and many other areas. If you go around the world, there's much more consternation and ambivalence about the idea of progress and a lot of negativity about the idea that progress is really not necessarily a good thing.
I was going to say that even here in the U.S., as thinkers are pushing technology, there's pushback. There are people who say, I don't want to email a shirt. I want my local economy to thrive. I don't want more technology. In fact, in The Atlantic, there's a wonderful essay by Walter Kern. He was on his cell phone while he was driving, and he couldn't believe he was about to drive his car off the road. And, you know, he realized all he cared about was trying to see a cell phone picture someone was sending him, despite this impending accident. He ends up concluding that the original American idea was freedom, but that that's been co-opted by technology. You know, companies selling their new items as providing more freedom, but he says, you know, freedom isn't the product to be sold.
Actually, I do think these technologies overall are very liberating and democratizing. I mean, we've democratized the tools of creativity. A couple of kids at Stanford wrote some software on their $1,000 laptops, revolutionized the world of web search, and started a company now worth $150 billion.
Eric Schmidt and Google. In fact, he's in the issue, and he says, to him, the American idea is newness.
And you're going to see kids in Africa with these $100 laptops that are being distributed, you know, creating movies and technology that will actually have a real impact. So technology alone is not going to solve problems. It's a very powerful tool. We still have to apply our ethical values and our social and political systems to move it in the right direction.
Do you see technology going forward as further dividing Americans between the haves and the have-nots, those who are going to end up emailing shirts? And
I feel very strongly that that's not the case, that rather than exacerbating the have-have-not divide, these technologies ultimately end up being extremely inexpensive. And we'll have an open source movement. We have an open source movement that makes information products available actually at no cost. I mean, you can get tremendous amounts of books and movies and whole encyclopedia and on and on and on for free, and the access to this is increasingly ubiquitous. You'll be able to actually live quite well with open source sources of information once we can turn information into physical products.
Rick Kurzweil, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And by the way, Ray is keeping himself healthy because he thinks the same nanotechnology that he just spoke of is going to keep all of us alive longer with nanobots that are going to enter the bloodstream to do repair work. Ray is founder of Kurzweil Technologies and one of several thinkers featured in the New Atlantic Magazine issue devoted to the American idea. Coming up, we'll speak with the magazine's editor on some of the other essays, including provocative thoughts from David Foster Wallace. Now, he asks the question, is the American idea more threatened by our response to Islamic fundamentalism than by Islamic fundamentalism? We'll have that. And also later, a U.S. soldier who's been awarded the Purple Heart and can now add the Legion of Honor. Back in just 1 minute, here and now. We're back with our conversation about the American idea. The 150th anniversary issue of The Atlantic is devoted to the question, what is the American idea and what are the challenges it will face in the future? The magazine asked a diverse group of thinkers to submit essays, and The Atlantic's editor, James Bennett, joins us now to talk about some of the responses. James, I want to start with the piece submitted by the political columnist George Will. He called your whole exercise into question.
Which was wonderful. His was the first essay I got back, and I received it within a few days of sending the letter out. And when I opened the envelope, I thought, you know, this feature may actually work. His was just a crackling response. Basically, George Will's view is it's inherently dangerous to put the definite article in front of the words American idea, that there is, in fact, a singular American idea, because inevitably, once you believe you have the idea, it becomes married to a missionary impulse in the world. If you have such a good idea, you want to spread it to everybody. So his view is that, paradoxically, the whole point of the American idea is that there is no singular American idea.
Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer had something of the same thought, because he said that one of the ideas of an American idea is the willingness to explore options, to not be too sure of oneself, a habit of mind that Judge Learned Hand once defined as the very spirit of liberty, the idea that, well, I'm not quite sure.
And this was the notion that undergirded this particular exercise, that we all agree on what the principles of this nation are. It's very easy to reach agreement on what's said in the Declaration of Independence, what's said in the Constitution. The fights we have constantly, the unresolved disputes of America, are all over how you apply those principles in practice.
Flip through, what the responses were, and give us some more of what you think were some highlights.
One of my favorite pairings, and it was purely serendipitous, was the pairing of Judith Martin, Miss Manners,
yes,
with Tom Wolfe, the journalist and novelist. They identified the same historical episode, but they took radically different conclusions from it. They both zeroed in on Thomas Jefferson's institution of what he called the pell-mell at the White House.
Yes, the pell-mell etiquette.
He did away with any seating arrangement at a formal dinner, and this was his effort to throw off the yoke of European tradition, the foolish hierarchy of Europe, and say that here in America, we're all totally equal. Find your own seat, basically.
Mm-hmm.
For Tom Wolfe, this was evidence of the great American spirit. This is the essence of the American idea, the utter egalitarianism. In fact, he identifies this as the very moment the American idea was born. For Judy Martin, whose fundamental belief is that the American idea is ultimately about respect and dignity for every individual.
And American etiquette.
And American etiquette. For her, this was the dangerous element in the American idea, that is, that it could go to the extreme of mob rule.
That's an interesting juxtaposition, but you have many of them. Religion comes up in the essays, and there are dueling essays between Sam Harris and Tim LaHaye. Sam Harris, author of The End of Faith, his essay is headlined God-Drunk Society. Tim LaHaye, of course, the minister who's known for the best-selling Left Behind series of books. He's a fundamentalist Christian. Can you give us a sense of, their back and forth?
Sam Harris sees America threatened by the foolishness of so many of the debates it's having internally now, which he traces back to a wrong-headed kind of obsession with religiously based ideas. What he says is, at a time we are actually threatened by Islamic fundamentalism, a rising tide of Islamic fundamentalism around the world, America should be gathering its allies together and standing for reason, that this is the fundamental American idea. Tim LaHaye, of course, goes in totally the opposite direction, saying that in fact we're becoming a godless society, that we're allowing a kind of atheistic humanism or a scientific humanism to override our essential fundamental American values.
Anna Deavere Smith writes that indigenous peoples were killed and people enslaved to carry out the American idea, but freedom eventually came. She worries that the problems with the environment will mean that maybe the American ideal won't have a future. And John Hope Franklin, tell us a little bit about him. He's a professor of history at Duke University, author
yes.
of the book From Slavery to Freedom. Tell us a little bit about his thoughts.
He offers a very skeptical take on the notion of the American idea. He refers to it as our Sunday best, our fancy dress. We like to pretend that we hold these ideals. We like to trot them out on special occasions and boast about them and pat ourselves on the back. And then we seldom actually put them into practice. His view is that American history is replete with examples of violent resistance to extending true equality to one group after another. And he concludes with the notion that it's getting rather late in the day, but maybe there's still some hope that we can put these ideals into practice.
Of course, he and others who had that sort of skepticism, Cornel West is another one, had mm-hmm. the freedom to write about it, in the magazine.
It was a recurring theme of several of the essays that we've fallen well
right.
short of this ideal that we've set for ourselves.
David Foster Wallace's was very...
Love that one.
Yeah, very
yes.
provocative. He asked, should an American idea be that we accept a certain amount of deaths from terrorism the way we accept, say, 40,000 deaths a year from traffic accidents, because we would never ban cars because of those deaths, and we shouldn't get rid of the freedoms that we have to make ourselves safer from terrorism. It was quite provocative.
Well, he begins by saying, are some things still worth dying for? Is the American idea one such thing? are you up for a thought experiment? What if we chose to regard the 2,973 innocents killed in the atrocities of 9/11 not as victims, but as democratic martyrs, sacrifices on the altars of freedom? He goes on to say, isn't our freedom to travel, our freedom of expression, is that worth the sacrifice of a certain number of lives to terrorist attacks that may result because we don't restrict those freedoms?
Right. And he ends by saying, is this a monstrous idea?
Yes.
James Bennett, editor of The Atlantic. Their 150th anniversary issue is about the future of the American idea. James Bennett, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks very much for having me.
And by the way, you can read the essays we spoke of at our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, from New York's leader to presidential candidate, Rudy Giuliani is leading his party's field in national polls. But who is he besides America's mayor on 9/11? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, a writer helps veterans find the words to tell their stories. Back after the news, Here and Now. The Veterans Day holiday is today, but most events honoring troops were held yesterday, November 11th, and at least one was held last week. French President Nicolas Sarkozy awarded France's highest award, the Legion of Honor, to seven U.S. veterans of the long World War II struggle to topple the German occupation of France. 63 years ago, American soldiers landed on the beaches of Normandy and launched a bloody offensive that would ultimately liberate France and solidify ties between the two countries. George Thompson of Milton, Massachusetts, was one of those knighted last week. His 15-year-old granddaughter, Rachel Russo, is in the French immersion program at Milton High. She helped her grandmother write the letter in French that nominated her grandfather. And Rachel joins us now. Rachel, what did you say in the letter?
We said that he was a hero when he had fought in World War II, and he was very young, and he took Americans across the River Roselle, and he helped free France. And he worked with heavy weapons.
We also know, earned a Purple Heart after he was wounded.
Yeah.
And as you said, he got the Bronze Star for bravery while helping people cross the Moselle River. Did you know this when you were growing up?
Yes, I did.
Yeah? What did you think about that?
It didn't really hit me until now because I didn't really know what he was talking about or my parents were talking about when they told me.
Well, I would say it would hit you now because you suddenly went all the way to Washington and met the French president. What was that like to see your granddad honored in Washington?
It was amazing. I was so proud of him. He doesn't think of himself as a hero, but I know he's proud to be got the Legion of Honor.
I know your granddad is a little bit hard of hearing, so he didn't, want to come to the phone today. But we understand another thing that you must have seen growing up is that your granddad goes out every day and hangs a flag.
Yes.
Has he told you why he does that?
Well, he's obviously honoring his country and that he fought in the country, but I'm not sure why he just doesn't leave it up.
That's Rachel Russo. She and her grandmother wrote the letter nominating her grandfather, George Thompson, for the French Legion of Honor. He was honored last week, along with Charles Shea. Charles is a Penobscot Indian from Old Town, Maine. He landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day and fought with the Allies through France up to the Battle of the Bulge. He was taken prisoner by the Germans after crossing the Rhine in March of 1945. He joins us now. And Charles, you are a medic in the prestigious 16th Infantry Regiment, 1st Infantry Division, 2nd Battalion, and a combat medic. You must have seen some pretty unpleasant things.
Yes, especially at Omaha Beach. I'll never forget treating the wounded, trying to rescue men that had been loaded down with gear. Their clothing was waterlogged, their boots were waterlogged. They were floating in the water trying to save their lives, and, I tried to help them.
You were taken prisoner, spent the last 6 weeks of the war in captivity. What do you think about, being honored now by France for helping to liberate France?
Well, I was completely overwhelmed, surprised. I have recently made a trek back to Europe with Professor Harold Prince, who nominated me for this citation.
Who was he that nominated you?
A distinguished professor of anthropology at the State University of Kansas.
How did he know about you?
I met his wife here at the reservation. She is also a author and anthropologist, and then she introduced me to her husband.
Hmm. Well, Charles, you're a Penobscot Indian.
Yes.
You have an ancestor, Chief Joseph Arno. We know the town Arno, Maine. He was an ally of George Washington during the Revolutionary War. What's the sense in your family of the importance of service, the meaning of service?
Well, the Penobscot Indians have always supported democracy of the United States from the very beginning. And we were very connected to the French government that was here in the United States. And we have always been friends with the French to this very day.
What was it like for you to go to Washington, given that?
It was very impressive for me. I consider it the pinnacle of my life. It will always remain in my memory. I'll never forget it.
What stood out for you?
The generosity, the graciousness, the elegance of the French people. It was very impressive.
You know, it's an honor for you, but I'm wondering if you feel responsible for also representing the Penobscot Nation.
That's the very important thing for me, to represent the people, my people, the Penobscot Indian Nation, and also to be representative of the Native American veterans in the state of Maine. I come from a reservation which, during the Second World War, we had only a population of 500 people on our reservation. And from this 500 people, we had 85 young men and women that participated in the military service, various branches, which is a very impressive record.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure they are very proud of you. I mean, there's been a lot of recognition of the Greatest Generation, but for a long time, I remember my uncle, who was at the Battle of the Bulge, would say nobody ever asked him about D-Day, not until the 50th anniversary. Do you think that's finally changing?
Well, I have never talked about my military experiences, neither to my wife or to my son.
Really?
Or to anybody all of my life. I was encouraged to come forward by Professor Harold Prince to get it on record and make it available to future generations, perhaps people that want to do research and hear the personal stories of men that actually participated in this operation.
You know, Charles, you lived extraordinary stories. You were part of the first wave to land on Omaha Beach, took part in several battles, not just the Battle of the Bulge, taken prisoner after crossing the, is it Remagen Bridge?
Yes, the Remagen Bridge had been destroyed by the time we crossed the river.
Right. I mean, these are all extraordinary pages from history. Why didn't you ever talk to anyone about it?
Well, I really don't know, but it was something that it was not very pleasant, and it was just something I wanted to push out of my mind, and I have been successful with pushing it out of my mind. I have finally come forward at the encouragement of somebody else.
Well, and you have been made a knight in the Order of the Legion of Honor. Do we call you Sir Charles now?
No, just call me Charles, please. Thank you.
Charles Shea, awarded the French Legion of Honor last week in Washington, D.C., joining us from his home in Old Town, Maine. Charles, again, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I just want to take a second to remind you that we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call. Leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. And this reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live. You can also download a podcast. Before we go today, superstar Jean-Louis Guerra and his music. You're listening to Here and Now. Right writer Sue Diaz of San Diego has been writing about the war in Iraq for the past 5 years, sharing stories about her son Roman, who's served 2 tours in Iraq. Now she's helping veterans come to terms with their experiences by leading writing workshops. Today, Sue Diaz shares her reflections on how stories, often untold, are a reminder of the sacrifices made on the battlefield.
Take another minute or two to bring your writing to a stopping point. I tell the 6 veterans sitting with me around a fold-out table at the San Diego Veterans Center. Their pens, moving more quickly now, make a soft rustling sound across the pages of their spiral notebooks. Looking up from mine, I wonder if that rustle in any way resembles sounds they might have heard or listened for on moonlit patrols decades ago along the Mekong Delta, a light wind through river reeds, a snake in a tree, the muffled footfall of Viet Cong. When I began leading this writing workshop several weeks ago, I expected that veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan would be the ones who'd sign up. As it turns out, this first group mostly remembers Vietnam. The heart of each session involves writing together. I'll offer a prompt, a word, a phrase, an object intended to get pens moving. We all write for 20 minutes or so, then take turns reading aloud what we've written. That part's always optional, but most in the group make that choice. It's a chance not only to be listened to, but in some instances, to at long last be heard. At our first workshop meeting, I offered the phrase, "It was a place called blank," and asked each member of the group to fill in that blank, to write from that place. I wanted to get a sense of where these veterans were willing to go. Most revisited some chapter from their youth or childhood. That first afternoon, only one from the group traveled on the page back to Southeast Asia. I took that to mean most might not want to go there. But in the weeks since, I am proud to say, they have proven me wrong. Here at our 5th meeting, I asked the group to list 3 significant people from any time in your life, childhood, high school, the service. Take a good look at your list. Then write about the person there who seems to be saying to you today, "Remember me." Taking up their pens, they set to work. 20 minutes later, Dwight volunteers to read. He looks up from his notebook, then back to the words he's just set down. The end-of-day sunlight, slicing through the room's bent mini-blinds, turns the gray in his dreadlocks silvery, and in a voice as deep as it is gentle, he begins. For the next few minutes, we are out on patrol in the jungle, walking stealthily, like cats, he writes, several yards behind a young man named Corporal Wilson. The corporal, coming upon what appears to be a booby trap, yells, "Stay back!" The group freezes. Wilson inches forward, jabs a mound of dirt in a cluster of grass with the butt of his gun. "Why he did that, I'll never know," Dwight interjects with a shake of his head. It is the last thing the corporal would ever do, his final act, ending in the explosion witnessed that day by the soldiers in Dwight's story, and now by all of us. One more war story among so many. Too many, any combat vet will tell you. But with stories such as this one, I'm learning from these veterans that it can take as much courage, maybe more, to pick up a pen later in life as it does to carry a government-issue M16 right after high school. Dwight's voice tapers off as the end of his story nears, and the silence of our listening deepens into something more, a hush that holds within it the echoes of every shot ever fired, every bomb ever dropped, every anthem ever played. It is the kind of moment for which there are no words. This Veterans Day, I have only these 2 to offer Dwight and all who have served. A heartfelt thank you.
Sleeping in these foxholes, hungry and cold. I had a dream last night.
Sue Diaz is a freelance writer in San Diego. Her Veterans Day thoughts also appeared in the Christian Science Monitor. Coming up, the music of Juan Luis Guerra, Here and Now.
Yes, I need want somebody to tell my mother and go down yonder in Georgia and tell my father.
At last week's Latin Grammy Awards, Dominican singer-songwriter Juan Luis Guerra and his band 440 beat all comers for Album, Song, and Record of the Year with the CD and title song La Llave de Mi Corazón. Juan Luis Guerra has been an international superstar for 20 years. In 2005, he made a rare appearance in Boston at the urging of José Masso, who hosts Con Salsa, a weekly program here at WBUR, our home station. We took that opportunity to ask José what makes Guerra's music so special.
I think what makes him special is that he was able to break out of his native country of Dominican Republic when he recorded Bachata Rosa. That was back in 1991. It allowed people to hear the magnitude of his repertoire, not only merengue from his native country, but also bachata, which is a beautiful romantic style bolero, salsa, which we know very well, but also some influences from Africa, some jazz, some big, lush arrangements of violins, but more than anything, it's his lyrics. He's a poet, Ramen. He is really, truly a poet.
And a socially responsible one as well. I'm thinking of the song where everybody raises an umbrella when he sings it. What's that?
Ojalá que llueva café. This wish, this prayer that rain coffee so that everyone can live a good life.
Ojalá que llueva café en el campo, sembrar un alto cerro de trigo y mapué, baja por la colina de arroz trameado y continúa el arado con tu querer. Oh, 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 oh. Ojalá el otoño en vez de hojas.
But his social consciousness is such that he has his own foundation, the Juan Luis Guerra Foundation, and just recently he won a Spirit of Hope Award during the Billboard Magazine Awards in April. This is because of the work the foundation does with children who are underprivileged children in receiving medical care. So he is someone who is not only giving throughout his music, but also giving throughout his work in his foundation.
He's got a Boston connection. He attended the Berklee School of Music here in Boston. Mm-hmm. And you can hear that jazz and sophisticated music influence in his songs.
Very much so. He's a graduate of 1982. When he first came to Berklee, it was to study guitar because he was a Pat Metheny wannabe. That's the way he says that. I was Pat Metheny wannabe. I wanted to play that guitar like Wes Montgomery. And then he discovered that he had something else to offer, which was his native music. And he went back and brought to the Dominican Republic what he had learned from Berklee as far as jazz compositions, vocals in particular. The Manhattan Transfer were very influential. And then at the same time, it was here in Boston that he met his future wife, Nora, and the mother of his children. So he has a very strong Boston connection. He loves this city.
Let's listen to a little more of his music. And I know you've got two songs. One demonstrates some of that musicality, that quick change that'll come when you least expect it. And another, the romance.
And they're both romantic in different ways, but I think the first has to do with the lyrics in the sense that it's Burbujas Amor, love bubbles, in which he wishes he were a fish that he could kiss his loved one through the window pane of the fishbowl. And then the second one, Cuando Te Beso, When I Kiss You, which is a very lush arrangement. You feel like you're in a movie theater seeing this great movie. And both are examples of how he is able to compose not only lyrically but musically. The first one, Burbujas Amor.
Corazón mutilado de esperanza y de razón. Tengo un corazón que madruga donde quiera. Ay, 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 ese corazón. Cuando te beso, todo un océano me corre por las venas. Nacen flores en mi cuerpo cual jardín. Y me abonas y me podas, soy feliz. Y sobre mi lengua se desviste un ruiseñor. Entre sus alitas nos amamos sin pudor.
Ah, the music. music of Juan Luis Guerra. You know, Jose, that I'm swooning. I love this music. And I'll name drop a little bit now. I was once at a party in Spanish Harlem, Maria Anahosa's house, and she was playing all this wonderful music. And I said, "Do you have Juan Luis Guerra?" And she said, "Oh, he's on the roof." And he happened to be visiting. And he's shy. I mean, very reclusive. And we understand became a born-again Christian.
Yes, a born-again Christian. And it's influenced his music in ways that his latest CD, Para Ti, which caught a lot of people by surprise because they didn't expect the CD to do well, but it has done very well with the lyrics that speak about his faith and his Christianity. The selection that I'd like to share with you is one that many people have identified with and has become one of probably the theme of the CD. It's titled Tan Solo He Venido, I've Only Come for This.
Solo quiero escucharte. Pon el tema, Señor. Caminar por el parque y dedicarte una canción. Tan solo he venido a estar contigo, a ser tu amigo.
Robin, this selection is one that when he performs it live, people actually cry. I mean, they sit there, hold hands, look at each other, and start crying because of the profundity of, you know, so profound the message that he has. And it's one that I really look forward to hearing him perform live.
Can you share with us just a few of the words of the song?
It's one in which he's actually praying. And he's praying to God, saying, "I've come to ask this, but I already know the answer because you've given me the answer before I've even asked it." And it sounds like a prayer, really. You know, it sounds like a real smooth way of praying to God.
The beautiful music of Juan Luis Guerra, huge superstar around the world. But Jose Maso, how exciting is it for Dominicans when he comes to the U.S.?
These days, I think the two things that most speak about Dominican pride here in the United States is baseball. Mm-hmm. And you can talk about Manny, and you can talk about David Ortiz or Pedro Martinez.
David Ortiz,
exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Or music. And the ambassador and the icon for this type of music is Juan Luis Guerra.
Here now is Jose Maso on Juan Luis Guerra. Now, a closing thought, if I may. I've spoken here about my late uncle, a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge, and my dad, who served at Guadalcanal. Today, a thought about Grandpa. He fought in World War I and, by all accounts, came home deeply damaged. Still, he became a successful clothing designer, but then a widower, an alcoholic, so bad my dad and his sisters were sent to an orphanage, and then a Bowery bum. I have a vague memory of officials depositing him at our front door in the 50s, how we, his grandkids, grew to love him, but his own son didn't know him. My dad lied about his age and joined the Marines at 15 to escape his childhood. Now there were two veterans under one roof, tormented by nightmares of war at night, but barely speaking to each other during the day. I recently asked my aunt, why did Dad bear this burden alone? And she said, at the time, it was New York State law that the destitute were the responsibility of the oldest child. There was nowhere else to go. I mention all this because today the New York Times writes that surveys show that half of America's 24 million veterans were homeless at one point in 2006. And last week, New York City announced that some of the homeless will be denied emergency shelter if the city believes they can stay with a family or friend. Well, I'm of course worried about that trend, having watched it tear my family apart, but I also wonder, if homeless veterans are a growing burden, isn't it a burden we, as a country, should all bear? Well, anyway, enjoy your Veterans Day. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.